But we're glad that you're here with us today for the last Sabbath of this calendar year, the Roman calendar year. And it's appropriate that we should begin considering the end of the year and what the new year shall bring in the sense of the Roman calendar year, starting off here with January 1st, the year 2001, the real millennium. Think about all that we went through this past year of the changeover. What was going to happen with the new millennium? Well, not much. Just people not knowing what to do with chads in Florida. Yeah, how to fill out a ballot. That was probably as bad as it got for the year 2000. But remember all of the great predictions of what was going to happen? None of that happened. Could it be happening in the year 2001? You know, the Odyssey movie, the Odyssey 2001, is that going to be a big deal now? When did that movie come out? Was it in the 60s? 1969? So it was like, you know, oh boy, will we ever make it to 2001? Well, that movie, I guess, will be being playing a lot in the year 2001, sort of like Prince and his record that he made in 1999. Which came out in the 80s or something like that. And, of course, he said he got very tired of the song and glad that 1999 has come and gone. Won't have to worry about it anymore. But as we come down to the end of a year, any particular year, but as we are in this hazy period of time of when the millennium starts or didn't start, we always get lists, you know, those lists come out, such as the top 10 grossing movies of the year. You gotta have those lists. You've got to have the top 40 recordings of the year. You have to have that. But you also have to have perhaps the 100 best stocks of the year. You've got to have these numbers to crunch and to deal with. Time magazine always comes out at the end of the year with a man or a woman of the year. This year it's George W. Bush, of course. It doesn't have to be that the person has done something positively significant, because one year they selected Adolf Hitler as the man of the year, Time magazine, you know, back in the 30s. I'm not putting George W. in that category. I'm just saying that they always have this man or woman of the year at the end of the year. Also, in sports figures, you got to have an athlete of the year. Probably will be Tiger Woods or something like that, with all the money he made from golf and so forth. So we have these lists that come out, and they all have to do with numbers. You know, whether you're adding, subtracting. In the case of the economy, you know, it's on a subtraction slide at the moment. I looked at some figures about the stock market. The NASDAQ, for instance, is down nearly 40% from what it was at the start of the year. And if you're playing the stock market, that's not a good number to hear. However, as you proceed along with any of the numbers that accumulate at the end of the year, they're either adding, subtracting, multiplying, or dividing. That's as basic of math as you can get. So when you realize that that goes on, the census that has been reported bears a little consideration, just from the point of view that numbers are involved, and every 10 years the Constitution requires that America have a census taken. And this year it's reported that we have increased our population to about 281 million plus people. The number is probably higher than that, but that's what was reported. That's what they could count. 281 million. And it's interesting that there's now a shift in the population. More people are moving to the south. Couldn't have anything to do with the snow in New York, could it? And so the population has changed to such a degree that now Texas is number two of all the states in the country in population. It has replaced the state of New York as number two in the nation because of the shifting population. The Southern Belt Arizona, New Mexico, Georgia, Alabama, certainly Florida is in that mix. They are picking up congressional seats because of people moving from the north to the south. So numbers are presently always with us. I also looked at a particular number that was troubling, that over the past 100 years, suicides have increased over what it was 100 years ago, the rate of suicides in the nation. Now, that's interesting. Why should that be? In the face of all of the prosperity that we have, all of the toys and gadgets, could it be that we are on a moral decline in some kind of way that causes great distress among people, so that the suicide rate has increased over what it was 100 years ago? And all of that in the light of the prosperity being at an all-time high. I looked at the parking lot out here, and won't call any names of cars, but it's a nice-looking parking lot. You know, there's some prosperity around here somewhere amongst us. And yet we think maybe it can get better. It should get better. It should at least be added to, or let's multiply it. Isn't that the talk around in political circles and in economic circles? Let's increase what we have. Let's grow it larger and larger. It should never diminish, is how some people look at it. And you know, the principle of growth is very important, but how, when we look at the circumstance of the church, can we take all of that number crunching? You know, whether we're talking about the increase in the economic structure of the nation, when we talk about the increase in population and how things are growing and magnifying and multiplying and all those kinds of things, what about the church? Not the same story, unfortunately. And I mean now the church as we know it, because I have said from this pulpit and other places that there are churches that to seem to be on an exponential growth incline, or a growth pattern that is staggering. When you can build sanctuaries that hold 7, 8, 10,000 people and have multiple services every week that you meet, I would say that as you glance at that, you would say, well, that's certainly growing exponentially. That's a lot of growth. But then when you look around at the tradition that we hold to, in the church as we know it, you do not see that. Now, why is that the case? What you see is a growth of organizations, groups with different alphabetic names, but basically you have a shifting of people between those organizations. Not new growth. Not the kind of growth that is displayed in the numbers that we hear crunched at the end of the year when we look at the population in general. But as the church goes, it is not growing. Now that is antithetical to the way God is. There are some people who explain it this way. Well, it's a good thing to have all of these divisions that have occurred within the church, because in having these divisions and having more groups who have more access to the public, it should cause more people, this is the theory, to cause more people to become converted to the truths of God. Now that is antithetical to the way God is. God is a multiplier. Satan is a divider. We have to think about that in the terms of, as we look at the society in general, but certainly as we look at the church. The optimum stat magnifier is that of multiplication. We all have gone through at least a portion of school to where we remember learning our times table, the multiplier situation. Adding is fine. I mean, it's good to add, but to multiply is best. You know, subtracting and division reduces things down to a smaller component. And when I suggest to you that God is a multiplier, that is, He expects things to grow and to expand, we like to harp on a little scripture that suggests that Jesus wanted the church to remain a little flock. No, that was not what he intended. In fact, when he called the congregation or the people that he was dealing with, 12 apostles and a few other followers that had totaled to 120 disciples by the time Jesus left, he called it a little flock. No question about that. But that little flock grew on the day of Pentecost by 3,000 additional people. And thousands more were added in the city of Jerusalem as a result of the preaching and the sharing of individuals who recognized that God indeed was a magnifier, a multiplier, and not a divider. And so we, in the midst of all of the news that floats around, and we are inundated with news resources today, it's easy to become confused, it's easy to become really chagrined and just get tired of hearing it. And then when you take a look at the church, as we know it, in our tradition, Sabbath keepers and so forth, we just see people being moved around through organizations. A few new people coming along, yes, but it is not in a multiplying factor as God would intend it to be. You see, God is a multiplier. Satan is a divider. Turn with me back to Genesis, the 17th chapter. And hear the word of the Lord as he speaks. No, not just speaks. Appears to Abram in chapter 17. We make a lot out of so much in the Bible, but I think we pass over and diminish the importance of certain things that are stated. Here in chapter 17 and verse 1 it says, when Abram was 99 years old, Yahweh, the Lord, appeared to Abram. That's a theophany. That's the appearance of the one we call God. Now, we come to learn later on through the New Testament that that individual was the one who became Jesus Christ. But it should not matter one way or the other in that issue, in that this being appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God, El Shaddai. Unfortunately, Almighty God is a poor translation. It should probably best be understood as all sufficient. All sufficient God. He walk before me and be you perfect, and I will make my covenant between me and you, and will multiply thee exceedingly. Multiply. Now, let's understand, when we backtrack to chapter 12, when God first gave him a command to leave the land of the Ur of the Chaldees and to go to where God was going to direct him, Abram was not a poor man. We go back to chapter 14. We find him securing the release of his nephew, Lot, and able to tithe of all of the booty that he had accumulated from the kings that had taken Lot captive. Lot took 300 hired servants from his household to go secure the release of Lot. Now, if you've got 300 people in your household, and these are workers, you have some money in the bank. Or somewhere. You've got herds. Even though you're dwelling in tents, quite fabulous tents, I'm sure. You've seen some of the tents that the sheiks live in over in the Middle East. I mean, these are fabulous places. And so I'm saying to you that Abram was not a poor man. And yet God here is telling him that I'm going to go into a covenant with you, and I'm going to multiply you exceedingly. Now, we could say that only applies to children. But in fact, it doesn't just apply to the fact that he's going to have a lot of children. Abram was increased, or God multiplied for him in such a way, and this is a truth that we must ascertain as followers of God. He goes on in verse 4 to say, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. Neither shall your name be any more called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made you. Abram was promised through the changing of his name to Abraham, that he was going to be multiplied by God because God is a multiplier. Satan, on the other hand, is a divider. I scurried around the scriptures to find a word that would have divided and where Satan would divide, and can't find one of those, though Jesus Christ, when he was accused of casting out demons, used the expression that is Satan divided in himself. If I'm of Satan, he is saying, am I divided against Satan by casting a demon out who is on the allegiance with Satan? So that's the only place you could find that, but you do find the principle of him being a divider right in the beginning. He divided Adam and Eve. The New Testament tells us that Adam was not deceived. But he caused a division between Adam and Eve to separate them, divide them from God. He also divided two brothers, Cain and Abel. And as we go through the history, we find that Satan was always lurking around in his attitude and his spirit to divide the children of Israel, even when they were just children, in the sense that you've got the 12 brothers, you've got one of them named Joseph, who thinks of himself more highly than he ought, with his dreams and his fantasies of what he was to be, and his brothers came to hate him. Now, hate is not of God. God is a multiplier. Satan is a divider. Eventually, Joseph is sold into prison, or sold into servitude as a slave, and winds up in Egypt. You know that story. But Satan is a divider. Even on the night in which Jesus was betrayed, Satan lurked around, influencing Judas Iscariot, and causing the disciples to argue among themselves who should be the greatest in the kingdom. On one occasion, Jesus said to Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Remember that? Because the division, the principle of division, of subtraction, is that of Satan, not of God. And then one occasion in 1 Chronicles 21, when David was desiring to number Israel, when God says, "Don't do that. You don't have to worry about it because I'm a multiplier. Whatever you need, I'll have for you. I'm all sufficient. El Shaddai," you know. And David understood that, but Satan, it says in 1 Chronicles 21, influenced David to number Israel against God's command. So when we see issues and principles of division and subtraction, you must lay it at the feet of the individual, the spirit being who has such an attitude, because it cannot be of God. So when we analyze where we are as a church and what it is that we are to do, we should come to this conclusion. We should align ourselves with the principles of God of being a multiplier, or that God can multiply us. Now, that's hard to do when you deal with the numbers. 5 years ago, we were a congregation down the road there, 100, averaging 100 people in attendance every Sabbath, somewhere in that range. Oh, it's wonderful. Numbers increasing and so forth, and that was looking good. And so what are our numbers today? And you look and you say, oh no, what's happening? What's going to happen? What are we going to do? Oh, the sky is falling. The end is near. Oh, please, Lord, have mercy. But perhaps we ought to begin turning to the multiplier in ways that we have not thought to do. And there are some instructions in the scriptures about that in the lives of people and situations that arise. Now, here's what I want you to consider. What you do with what you have is important. What do you have? What do we have? We've got this property out here, and whether it sells or doesn't, you know, God has something to say about that. You know, we can do our thing, but God has something to say about it. And perhaps we ought to really think about asking him, well, what's your will on this? What do you want? It appears that he doesn't want it sold. It's not selling. I mean, that's how you could look at it, looking at the numbers, crunching the numbers, because there's a principle at work here. What God puts in your hands will determine how you respond to the love of God showered upon you. What He puts in your hands. Let's turn over to Exodus, the fourth chapter. Because I don't know of a better example of an individual who had been brought down from a high place. Moses had been significant in the courts of Egypt. Being raised in the courts of Egypt as a family member, like a son to the Pharaoh of Egypt. And the accuracy of the presentations of the Ten Commandments by Cecil B. DeMille and the animation Prince of Egypt, extracted from the histories of Josephus and other historians that you don't find in the scriptures, confirmed that Moses was a consequential figure in Egypt. And yet, after 40 years there, he escapes, runs away, leaves, is ostracized, whatever the historical fact is, and winds up in Midian, close by this holy mountain called Sinai, and the Sinai Peninsula and Mount Horeb. He's a shepherd now. He's got a staff in his hand, and he's out watching the sheep. He's doing that kind of thing. But every day he goes by and he sees this bush that is not burned up. It's on fire, but it won't burn up. Now, I don't know about you, that would raise a certain curiosity to want to investigate it, or maybe run the other way, but in his terms, he wanted to investigate it, so he comes and the bush speaks to him. Or out of the bush comes a voice. So now he is talking to a great being. And this great being is going to commission him to go back to Egypt and to lead his people, the Israelites, out of 400 years of bondage into the promised land that God had prepared for them. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd have objections if God were to come to me with such a plan. First of all, I don't want to go back to Egypt because my life may be in jeopardy. I killed a man over there. The current Pharaoh is the fellow who I grew up with as my brother. Probably is not all that happy about me showing up again because I kind of was the favorite of Seti, the great Pharaoh of the time, who adopted me into his household, and I was more favorite to him than his own legitimate son. So I don't want to go back to Egypt. I don't want to do that. So he comes up with objections in chapter 4. In chapter 4 and verse 1, Moses answered and said, "But behold, they will not believe me," speaking of the children of Israel, "nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, the Lord has not appeared unto you." And the Lord said unto him, "What's in your hand?" Now God always seems to cut to the chase and ask these kinds of questions. And he asks Moses, "What's in your hand?" He asks that same question today. What's in your hand, church? What do you got? As I go back in history, I've been around a long time, and go back to the days of Pasadena, California, when the Worldwide Church of God had 3 college campuses, multiple jets, many television outlets and radio and free literature, correspondence courses, offices all over the world. What a time. The Golden Age is what it was called. But you know, that's no longer in the hand of the Worldwide Church of God. In fact, what has happened is the diminution, the subtraction and the division that has occurred to where there are all kinds of groups, all residual from the Worldwide Church of God, all trying to do something. Some are on TV, some are not, some are on radio, some are not, some are on the internet, some are not, some meet, you know, in small conclaves, and others, you know, perhaps have a few more hundred here or there. Some are independent, some are connected to organizations, all kinds of things. God still asks, "What's in your hand?" Because whatever is in your hand, whatever God gives you, he expects you to do something with it. Moses responded, a rod. A shepherd's crook. That's all that he had in his hand. He didn't have armies. Didn't have millions. He was only alone with a rod in his hand. If God is a multiplier, you can never give him the excuse, we don't have enough. We're too small. We can't do it. He won't buy it. Did he buy it from Moses? He did not. A rod, that's what you have. And he said, cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from before it. So would I. So would you. If you're not prepared to deal with that. In verse 4, and the Lord said unto Moses, put forth your hand and take it by the tail. And he put forth his hand and caught it and became a rod in his hand. I suggest to you that that act was an act of faith. Pick up the rod by the tail, pick up the snake by the tail, took some faith. But the command came from God to do it. And my suggestion to you is that since God is a multiplier, he can take whatever is in your hand. What do you have? We've got a property, we've got a television program, radio program, we've got literature going out, we've got people responding and internet access and all that kind of thing. There are things in our hands. What will we do with them? If God is a multiplier, he can manifest some great things from it. Now, you know the rest of the story concerning Moses. I won't belabor that. But the point is that if you see what happened with Moses is that whatever you have with God on your side is enough. It was enough for Moses. It was also enough for a young lad named David in 1 Samuel 17. I love this story because David in his teen years and his youth was confronted with obstacles. First of all, he was the youngest. He was the kid. He was, you know, the last of the litter, so to speak. With older brothers and older siblings, you know, the younger ones get put in their place often. You can't go. You're too young. Stay behind. So there he was, back at home, minding the sheep, when the word came from Saul, the king, that he would like to have David, who was proficient as a musician, to come and be his armor bearer. If you look at verse 32, after David has come, and David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Now, this is after David has showed up in the area, and he hears this Goliath ranting and raving out there against the armies of the living God. And it concerned David to this degree. Now, he's got all of his older brothers in the military there. Now, you would think that the older brothers who had, you know, had been to war and had some exploits and that kind of thing would have been the ones to stand up and volunteer, but no. No, they didn't. No one came forward, not even Saul himself. So David said, now, don't worry about this Philistine. Saul said to David, you're not able to go out against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. You know, as I get older and older, I try not to look at young people in the way that I was looked at when I was young by older folk. Children should be seen and not heard. You've heard that? Because we'd like to think that older folk know best all the time. But every now and then you have to be like Job to sit and listen to Elihu, the young man who sat and listened to his three older friends rant and rave about what they thought Job's problem was, and none of them got it, but Elihu, the young man, understood it. And he said to them, permit me, with all due respect, to speak up and to share what I have. And so here's young David being told by Saul, you're but a youth. David said to Saul in verse 34, "Your servant kept his father's sheep. There came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. I went out after him, smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth. When he arose against me, I caught him by the beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he has defiled the armies of the living God." I suggest to you that when you begin crunching the numbers, and as you go through and seeing the handwriting on the wall, "Oh, we can't make it, we can't do this, we can't accomplish what God has set before us," I suggest you look at David's example. Oh yeah, there's a Goliath out there. The Goliath of finances, Goliath of discouragement, always speaking, whispering. Satan the divider, you know, is behind the scenes. To attempt to suggest that you cannot do what needs to be done. David said, moreover, verse 37, "The Lord that delivereth me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said unto David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Well, David goes out. They try to put him on all of this armor of the king and so forth, and to go out and do battle. And he said, "No, I can't do this." In verse 39, "I have not proved them," and David put them off. Verse 40, what did he take? He took his staff in his hand. It reminds you of a question put to Moses. What's in your hand? And he chose 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag which he had, even in a scrip. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. This is fascinating to me because my first question probably out of this is, why 5 stones? You know, there's only one Goliath. Why do you need 5 stones? Well, the theory goes that Goliath had 4 other brothers. In case they wanted to jump bad, he had something for them too, because it only took 1 stone for David to do to Goliath what needed to be done. All he had in his hand was a staff, a slingshot, and these stones. And he was successful against the Goliath because he knew that God could multiply his strength, multiply his effect, or multiply his accomplishment. It's important that we comprehend that God is able to do that. That is his promise. That's what he promised Abraham. And that's what he promises the children of Abraham. "I will multiply you as the stars of heaven, as the sands of the sea." That was the promise to Abraham and to his children, of whom we are supposed to be. In multiplying, we must not lose sight of other examples that show up in the scriptures. There was a boy one time back in John the 6th chapter, John 6, who found himself probably out of curiosity one day, having had a lunch or a meal prepared for him, and he found himself in a situation of a crowd, about 5,000 men, who knows how many women and children, who were following this charismatic leader, this speaker, this person who claimed to be the Son of the Living God. And the situation arose to where there had to be a discussion about feeding this mob of people. Let's see. I said John 6. I think I have the wrong... Oh, there it is, right in the very beginning. John 6. And let's begin in verse 5. "When Jesus then lifted his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he said unto Philip, When shall we buy bread that they shall all eat? And this he said to prove him," that is to check out Philip as well as himself, to prove himself to the people, for he himself knew what he would do. He wanted to see, and many times, this is amazing, that God would want to see where our faith is. What is it that we really believe? Do we believe that he's a multiplier, or does he expect us to limp along, you know, just kind of eating humble pie and never arise to the level of those individuals with whom he worked with in the past? Is that it? We'll always be God's poor, you know, downtrodden, insignificant, inconsequential. We look and see and marvel at what happens in other circles, and we say, wow, that's amazing. Oh, I wish it could happen here. No, wishing won't make it so. Wishing will not make it so. We have to have a proof within ourselves, as this young man was able to display as a result of what Jesus decides to confront his disciples with. Verse 7 says, Philip answered him, well, 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. Now one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said unto him, there is a lad. And by the way, John is the only account that mentions the lad. The others mention what he had. But I like the fact that there's this lad, this kid, like David. You know, small, insignificant, what can he do? Which has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, prepared by his mother, perhaps, sending him out on a day's journey to have fun at the seashore, where they were located at this point at Tiberias, around the Sea of Galilee. Go down to the seashore and have a day. Do a little fishing, you know, a little have a little fun, and I prepared this meal for you. Got you 5 loaves and 2 fish. Maybe he was carrying it down to his father who was working on the shore. Whatever the circumstance, this lad is there in the midst of this 5,000 men, and who knows how many women and children. And here's the situation. But what are they, verse 9 says, among so many? 2 fish and 5 loaves. Jesus says, make the men sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down and numbered about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, 5 loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them that were set down, and likewise of the fishes as much as they would, that is, how much they wanted to eat. And when they were filled, he said unto his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. Therefore they gathered themselves together and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves and the 2 fish, which remain over and above unto them that had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, this is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world. I look at numbers very interestingly. Got a worldwide news sent to us, and it had some figures in there about the income of the worldwide Church of God, about $24 million for the year. Now, that sounds good to those of us who are slightly under $2 million. I mean, that would be nice to have $24 million coming in, but you see, the worldwide Church of God, when I was there, used to have an annual income in excess of $200 million. Probably as high as $250 million per year. It's down now, I guess you could say, in all of the churches to 2 fish and 5 loaves. And we say we can't do this and we can't do that, not recognizing that the God we serve is a multiplier. He will not agree with our assessment of what we can and cannot do. He's given us too many examples in the scriptures of how he took little and did a lot. And time doesn't even permit me to talk of Gideon's army. Started out at 32,000. And by the end, there were 300 people in that army that conquered their enemies. You know, what are we to do with this book? Is it just something to sit on a table? To kind of read through stories like a novel, you know, and then be forgotten? Or does it have application? In Mark, the 12th chapter, There are two accounts of this. Luke has one, but Mark, the 12th chapter, has this issue about the widow's mite. You know that story? Chapter 12 of Mark and verse 41. The parallel account is in Luke 21. Jesus set over against the treasury and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury. And many that were rich cast in much. Oh, sure, that's to be expected. And every now and then we get a large donation that comes in, and it staggers the mind that someone is able to do that. Maybe it's accumulation of tithes. Maybe a sale was made. Who knows how that happens? But it's added to the treasury. It's added to the pot. But many times, our view and what moves us is not what moves God. It's not what catches God's attention. It's not the much that catches God's attention. But it's the mite of the little. Look at this in verse 42. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. A mite was about one-eighth of a penny or a cent, one-eighth of a cent. And you put two of them together, you get a quarter. A farthing would be a quarter of a penny. That's inconsequential. In fact, it's the smallest amount in the Bible that you can find. When the Bible talks of denominations of money and so forth, that's the smallest recognition that you can find of a mite, is the smallest quantity. Now, Jesus says this, he called unto him his disciples. He calls to his disciples today to take a look at this example and said unto them, verily I say unto you that this poor widow has cast more in than all they which cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living. It's hard to speak on that issue because you don't know how to convey to people that they must put their all on the altar. The song that goes, is your all on the altar of sacrifice laid? And we tend to say, well, no, not all of it. I tithe. Yeah, I give a tithe, and I'm faithful about my tithe, but if I see a need or something like that, I'm not moved to do anything about it. Let somebody else do it. Because what's mine is mine, what's yours is mine. No, that can't be the way it is. And Jesus here uses this illustration of a woman who gave her all. Now, for those who would be listening to this sermon down the road and thinking, oh, well, he's asking for more money to be sent into the church. No, I'm not. Because whatever is in our hand, $1.8 million, which is a nice piece of change, $1.5 million, $2 million, $3 million, whatever, the figure, doesn't matter. Whatever is in our hands, we are expected to do as God did with Moses, with David, with the young boy with the two fish and the five loaves, and with the widow's mite. Because God, the great multiplier, gives us the ultimate gift. John 3:16. For God so loved the world, he gave one son, one, that was to transform the world. And you and me. You see, in Romans the 8th chapter, when we speak of God being a multiplier, despite whatever is going on around, and there's great consternation now about the stock market and the economy and the downward trend and the possibilities of a recession. You know, oh, that may happen. Ooh, what are we going to do? Well, depends on where you have your trust. You know, if you trust in the stock market, it will go down. How do I know that? It's history. It always goes down. as it goes up and down and up and down. It depends on when you get in. That's why they counsel people, you got to stay for the long haul so it averages out somewhere along the way. But if you trust in that, if that's what's in your hand, what are you going to do when it's no longer in your hand? You have to have something in your hand that God can use. Because God gave us a son. He's within our grasp. We can cling to him. For we learn in chapter 8 and verse 29 this. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestine to be conformed to the image of his son. That's you and me. God determined that he was going to have some children to go with that firstborn son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Multiplication, we can't even tell you what the number is going to be. The population of the United States, as it's announced this cycle, is 281 million. There are 6 billion people on the earth, and it's growing all the time. And who knows how many people have lived on the earth from the beginning of Adam and Eve till now. And every one of them, in the eye of God, is a possibility of being a child of God. And is made possible through one son. God being the multiplier of our gifts. Galatians, the fourth chapter. Galatians 4 and verse 5 tells us more insight into what God intends to do. To redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. As I've explained in the past, an adoption in the Greek world, in the Roman world, was far more consequential than we think of it as in today's terms. You literally became part of this person's family. I love the issue in the movie Ben-Hur, when Ben-Hur is adopted by the Roman general, or admiral, or whatever he was, who was the commander out there at the time that Ben-Hur was a slave in the galleys of the ship. Winds up saving the general's life and going back to Rome and driving the chariots and the great Circus Maximus there, and ultimately becoming adopted by the general. And he went through the ceremony with the ring and letting everyone know that this is my son. He has every right and every privilege as if he were born of my own body. That's what an adoption meant in those terms. No residuals, no wall, no barriers, no, well, you're kind of my child, you know, I adopted you and I brought you in, but you're really not mine. No, nothing like that. And then in Hebrews, the second chapter, after speaking of how God had spoken to us in sundry times in many ways by the prophets, Hebrews 2 and verse 10 says this, for it became him for whom are all things, Jesus Christ, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. Speaking of Jesus Christ. Many sons. You want to talk about multiplying? God gives us gifts. He gives us challenges. It's like the word that we read there in John, that Jesus wanted to prove Philip. He wanted to find out, well, how are you thinking, Philip? How are we going to feed all these people? Now, bear in mind, they had seen Jesus doing some unbelievable things even to that point. They had seen him change the water to wine. They had seen him heal people, including Peter's mother-in-law. So he asked the question of people who are supposed to know better. How are we going to feed all these people, Jesus asked, all the while knowing what he was going to do. Well, if we had 100 pennies worth, we couldn't feed all of these people. It's just not possible. No, it's impossible. What can we do? Oh, woe is us. And through the scriptures, we see these examples continually of God saying, what's in your hand? What's in your hand? How many people's lives have been blessed by God's multiplication process? How many? I think back to my mother's circumstance. I remember one day, summer, I think it was, and maybe it was school time. I can't remember now that part, but I do remember playing on the street that we lived on. We had moved to this neighborhood. She worked as an elevator operator in a hospital, and it was tough times. I remember, you know, her making some cornbread, and we may have had some beans. I just don't remember, you know. Whatever it was, that's what we had to eat, and was no talking about, I want some McDonald's. You know, we didn't have a vote about it. But I saw her come around the corner on this particular day, and she was pretty weary, and it was later than she would normally have come home, but when you're playing, you don't think about those things. But she came on pretty distressed and went on to the house, and later on it was when she told me that she had walked home from work about 4.5 miles from the hospital to where we live, because she could not bring herself to borrow another quarter. I think that's what the bus fare was in those days, to get a ride home. As I grew older and began to understand some things, you know, you can wind up in situations where you don't have much and you don't know how you're going to make it, but she was a praying woman, the kind of person who turns to God in those moments when it doesn't seem like you can stretch whatever it is that has to be stretched. See, I couldn't tell you about the little cruse of oil and the little meal of the widow who fed Elijah and herself and her son for 3.5 years. I couldn't tell you that story. But it's there for a reason. That God is able to supply all of our needs and riches and glory. The Bible tells us that the cattle on 1,000 hills belong to Him. So whatever it is we have need of, He can multiply our gifts. If it is going to work, it will be because God multiplies what we have. And we've got to start thinking in those terms, and not about what we don't have and what we lost. Because God supplied Job with everything that he lost and multiplied it. That's the scripture. That's a word from the Lord. He multiplies our gifts if we would but believe it.